On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the 2019 Quality Roadmap and current activities at the HHC with Taryn English, Assistant Director, Regulatory Compliance, and update listeners on the final 2020 payment rule.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 72 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for November 3rd, 2019. Recording from our studio in Spencerport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So, John, you're heading out to two different conferences.
That's right. And you've been warning me all morning long that I need to get moving.
You are running out of time.
I'm running out of time. So here we are trying to record this pretty quickly before I hop in the car. Actually, I need to clean out the car first and then hop in the car to head out. So Alex Borneman and I are heading down to Pennsylvania for the Pennsylvania State Association meeting at the Hershey Lodge in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We're going to have a booth there. And I'm pretty sure that if you haven't made plans to be there and you're from the state of Pennsylvania, you can still head out there to join your fellow Pennsylvanian ASCs for a wonderful conference. If you're going to the conference, make sure you say hi to us while we're there. And then later on in the week, on Wednesday and Thursday, the New York State Association meeting is in Tarrytown, New York, at the DoubleTree in Tarrytown.
And you will be speaking?
I will be. And actually, Lori Rodericks is going to be speaking there also. And we have a booth, and we're recording two podcasts there. We're recording a regular podcast where we're going to talk about, you know, various things that, you know, are applicable to everybody in the country. And then we'll have a special podcast for New York State people.
And we have a lot that is coming up on the next few podcasts.
Yeah, this is a busy, as we go into the end of the year, we have a full schedule. Literally, I think it's just about every week we're going to be recording at least one episode, just so much to fit in before the end of the year. So just to talk about what's coming up this week, we are going to be recording while we're at the Pennsylvania Association. We're going to try to do a summary of the final payment rule. I'm going to give a very quick overview today, but then we'll go into some more depth on the final payment rule. Hopefully that'll be out middle of this week. And then we're going to do a live from the New York State Association meeting podcast where we're going to talk about the sessions and information that would be applicable for everybody in the country.
Lots of good sessions coming up there. I'm looking forward to it.
It's a wonderful conference. And most of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, the staff will be there. We have two people we had to keep back, unfortunately. They drew the short straws,
yes.
I think.
But mostly Jenna and I will be doing a lot of the registering, and so we'll be at the desk there.
So again, if you're from New York State and you're attending the conference, make sure you stop by and say hi to us at the booth. And then we're going to do a special episode for New York State Surgery Centers, and we'll talk about items that are very specific to New York State, and we're going to talk to the association leaders. And then next week on November 11th, we have a guest, Ted Gottes. He's a senior vice president from MedTrainer's Quick Cred Division. We're going to be talking about credentialing. MedTrainer is, of course, one of our new sponsors, and they have a series of about three episodes that they're sponsoring. The week of November 18th, we have an interview with my friend Bob Zaza, where we're going to be talking about developing new services. So this is a topic we haven't talked about yet on the podcast over the last 2 years. So I'm excited to kind of talk a little bit about what's going on there. And then the week of November 25th, which I believe is Thanksgiving week, we have an interview with Tamar Glazer from MedTrainer to discuss accreditation. And then in December, we don't have all the plans made out yet exactly which week, but we're going to be talking about cybersecurity, training and education, productivity, and hopefully we're going to do some sessions with Lori Rodericks on infection control. And we're going to try to get together with Tom Salamone, who's our dear friend, talk about life safety, OSHA, the various issues there.
Now, I remember when we first started this podcast, I was so concerned that if we were doing one every other week or even once a month, we would run out of topics so quickly.
I don't think that's
not happening.
Not at all. I know. It's so exciting to see. And of course, thankfully, our listeners are always giving us some suggestions for new topics. So please keep that up. Mm-hmm. And we're really trying to cover the whole spectrum here. And we are, as you'll see, including a lot more financial topics. And we're going to ramp up the infection control. One of our goals here is to start providing continuing education for infection control preventionists through the podcast. So we've been working with Lori Rodericks on that, and hopefully that'll be kicked off sometime in December. And of course, the podcast is growing. I noted that we have a number of new sponsors coming on board as the new year starts, and we're excited that our listenership is growing fast. We're well above 11,000 downloads now. So if you're a vendor looking for advertising or sponsorship opportunities, now's the time to contact us. Make sure you send me an email at info@ascpodcast.com. And we just want to remind our listeners to subscribe and become a patron of the podcast to support our ongoing efforts. So please go to the website at ascpodcast.com, and you can find out all the benefits of becoming a patron, which includes free AEUs, up to three, maybe even more AEUs a quarter, starting in the fourth quarter. Access to exclusive content, special discounts on my books, including almost $150 off the purchase of all three books, and a lot more things to come. So starting members, as we kick off the program, the price is only $10 a month.
And I saw referenced in the Associated Press a report called the 2019 Ambulatory Surgery Center Market Report that just had some interesting facts about the ASC industry. So the USASC market is estimated to grow to $52 to $55 billion by 2025. The top six ASC chains hold a combined 18.8% of total market share and manage 1,300 ASCs. The ASCs, as I think many of us know, are largely urban, with 92.9% located in or near cities. And the ASCs continue to perform more than half of all U.S. outpatient surgical procedures and are expected to see greater volumes as the number of outpatient procedures increases by an estimated 15% by 2028. The largest jump they're predicting will occur in spine procedures, approximately 10%. And they made the point that cost savings is mostly due to efficiency. 2018 operating expenses were 67% of net revenue in ASCs, whereas in hospital outpatient departments, this figure was 97%.
So again, a very strong case for the ambulatory surgery industry, mm-hmm. how we can save the Medicare program significant dollars. And of course, we know the quality is high. So that was great news.
Yep.
And on November 1st, CMS released the 2020 payment rule for ambulatory surgery centers and hospital-based departments and surgery centers, also known as HOPDs. CMS, and by the way, they actually issued it on time, November 1st, given that they were late in getting the proposed rule out in July. It was nice to see they were on time for the final rule. CMS did go with the July proposal to add eight codes to the list of procedures that are payable by Medicare in the ASC setting, including total knee arthroscopy, also known as TKA. CMS continued to use the hospital market basket update factor to the ASC rate, which is the same mechanism that's used in hospital outpatient departments. And they indicated that they will continue to use it through at least 2023. So that's really good news for the industry. As we know, in the past or prior to 2019, they used the consumer price index, which is not at all fair, not at all representative of the costs that we incur in an ambulatory surgery setting. And the average increase over all of the CMS-approved ASC procedures was 2.6%, which is made up of a 3% hospital market basket increase, less a productivity reduction of 0.4%. However, unfortunately, this doesn't mean that all of your rates will go up by 2.6%. There's still a sequestration adjustment of 2%, which is still in place. And of course, there is that rebalancing of various procedures that causes some specific procedures to go up and some to go down. So your mileage will vary. And I think generally we're very pleased with the 2020 payment rule. And our friend Bill Prentice from the ASC Association made a couple comments in a press release. And this is what he said. He says, "We are grateful that this proposed rule continues the sound policy of updating ASC Medicare payments for inflation on par with hospital outpatient departments." And he continued by saying, "In addition, proposing to add total knee arthroscopy to our procedures list so soon after moving it from the inpatient only list as well as other as a number of other cardiac codes speaks well to the confidence that CMS has in the ability of physicians to use well-established patient selection criteria to move appropriate patients to the lower-cost ASC settings." I do want to say, on behalf of the industry, I want to thank the ASC Association for their hard work on putting together the comments and making sure that the final rule was fair to the industry. And as always, we really want to encourage our listeners to support the ASC Association by becoming a member at ascassociation.org. So let's take a break and come back, and we're going to have our focus segment, which is an interview with Taryn English.
We have the pleasure of interviewing Taryn English, Assistant Director, Regulatory Compliance for the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, better known as AAHC. This was our first attempt at using our new remote recording system, so you'll have to bear with us as we learn to become better podcasters. And unfortunately for poor Taryn, we ended up having to re-record the session. But we were able to finally do it, and I think the results are well worth it. So here is our interview with Taryn English.
So this is John Gailey. I'm here with Sue and Taryn English from the AAHC. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you.
So things are kind of busy at AAHC this month, or last month, I should say. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. So AAHC is enjoying a very high volume survey month. We've got a lot of clients that are new to accreditation and excited about going through the process. So we're happy to have them on board.
Absolutely. And we just talked about AAHC in two episodes ago, which had the best ratings of all of the major accrediting organizations for compliance with the CMS standards. So congratulations on that also.
Oh, that's excellent. I did hear that episode. So I love to hear it.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for joining us. It's been a while trying to get you on our podcast here. And when we were trying to figure out what to talk about, you suggested that the quality roadmap would be a really good thing to bring up at this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us what the quality roadmap is.
Yes, so the quality roadmap is something that we do on an annual basis, and that's a report on our accreditation survey results. So for any of our clients who attended our quarterly Achieving Accreditation program, they already got a sneak peek of this. It was available during that program, or if you caught us at one of the events we've recently been to, it was available there as well. But it's going to be distributed to all accredited orgs with our Triangle Times newsletter this month, so watch your mailboxes for that. But basically what this report does is it takes data from approximately 1,200 surveys that happened in the previous year. All organizations that had either an initial survey, so a first-time survey with us, or reaccreditation. And it's really a report of our results so that we can learn from each other and then take action together. So you can kind of see where you fell within your own deficiencies. You can compare it with your survey report to see if other organizations struggled with that area, but also to learn from where organizations have struggled.
So let's start with the good news. What were those areas that the surgery centers tended to have a very high compliance?
Well, not surprising to me, but 99% of our organizations were compliant with treating patients with respect, giving them information about their diagnosis and involving them in treatment decisions. And kind of we attribute that to organizations that are seeking accreditation are really committed to their patients first and foremost. So that wasn't surprising to me that our organizations who are undergoing survey are treating their patients with respect. So that's great. Another thing that we do measure in that report right there in the beginning is our areas of improvement, like places we've seen improvement from previous reports. So I've got a couple of those here. Again, they kind of fit the same flavor of what I just talked about, but providing patients with the opportunity to participate in decisions involving their care, having healthcare professionals trained in the use of emergency equipment and having a safe evacuation plan, identifying a purpose for the org's QI program. That's an area that we had previously seen organizations struggle, but now we're seeing great compliance with. as well as having resuscitation equipment available for the administering at least 90% of the oxygen. So these are just a couple of the few that we've seen that organizations have really improved in over time.
So that leads us to the next question. Where are there some areas that the organizations could stand some improvement?
Yeah, so I think that our challenges really all fall into four categories. So we've got documentation. So really, this relates to our clinical record chapter. Also, credentialing and privileging is sometimes can be challenging for organizations. Patient safety, and then QI studies. So those are kind of the four main categories that these challenge areas do fall into.
So I think credentialing is probably one of the toughest areas, just from my experience too. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of those issues that are raised in many surveys?
Yeah, absolutely. So and what our report has done is it's taken the Medicare deemed status clients and compared them also, set aside from them, the non-Medicare deemed status clients. And the reason we do that, just to get a little background, is when we're looking on a Medicare deemed status survey, we're not only looking for HHC standards, but also the CMS conditions for coverage. So because of that, our standards may be a little different program to program. So when I talk about these things, I'll break them out by Medicare, non-Medicare. So when we talk about credentialing and privileging for non-Medicare, one of the main issues that kind of rose to the top of the challenge list was our standard 2, subchapter 2G. So that is the standard of requirement there is the governing body approves appointment and reappointment decisions. And the elements within that are that applications are reviewed by the governing body, peer references and or peer review activities are included with the results, and they're used as kind of a basis to make decisions, and then those decisions, those actions are documented. And that was actually for our non-Medicare deemed status clients, the number 2 issue that we saw in this report.
So let's talk a little bit about peer review, because I know that's one of those areas that a lot of the centers really struggle with. Do you have mm-hmm. some recommendations or just some comments based upon the roadmap?
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges, is, especially for organizations that are just starting out, is to determine what you want to review. So we need to keep in mind that peer review should be a regular thing that you do on an ongoing basis. So it shouldn't just be limited to the problem areas or the adverse events that happen. So it shouldn't just be incident-based. You do need to decide how you're going to determine that your program is ongoing and make sure that you're reviewing people on a regular basis and then taking action on those results. So that's a really great area for some internal benchmarking, is a wealth of data as you're measuring your important aspects of care. And then certainly, as I just talked about, making sure that you are taking those results and then incorporating them into your reappointment decisions.
And of course, we're going to want to see the results of that peer review being reported all the way up to the governing body too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, and this will probably come up a couple times as I'm going through the results. What we want to focus on is making sure that our surveyors are able to see evidence that something's happened. So while it's great that something did happen, if it's not documented, that can be a challenge for our surveyors when coming to assess the standards.
So when we're talking peer review, we're not just talking random chart audits also, and we're not talking about doing this every 2 years just or 3 years, depending upon your re-credentialing cycle. We want to see some evidence of, first of all, ongoing stuff that's done every year. We want to see that the clinical incidents are reviewed by a peer. That's a relatively new, no, it's always been there, but now it's actually in writing that any of those events have to be peer reviewed. And we kind of want to see a summary report, correct? What type of summary report is usually seen in a surgery center?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to make a note about that word ongoing. I think that some of the most common questions we get is really what's right for us, what is ongoing. And HHC really doesn't define how many chart audits you should do or what would be ongoing, just because our centers differ. Everybody is their own unique center and has to determine what that's going to be. So, if 5% of chart audits would be appropriate in your center, that would be acceptable as long as you can prove that it's ongoing. So I did want to hit on that. But then, as you said, kind of coming up with a summary of what you've learned, not only on an individual provider, and that's something that you could use in the reappointment decisions, is that summary of that provider's performance on those aspects of care that you've defined, but also as an organization in comparing providers to each other. And that's a way to get a great QI study if you find that you have an issue in a particular area and everyone's struggling with it. How can you improve that as an organization?
And we have to also remember that peer review isn't just for the physicians and the anesthesiologists, but also the allied health professionals, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yes, 100%.
And when we're doing that, there could be a wide variety of things. Like I just came from a center just this morning that their peer review, they were lucky because they had a bunch of CRNAs and they could peer review each other, but that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. But you can always have like an anesthesiologist peer review the CRNA. Of course, the CRNA can't peer review the anesthesiologist, but either of those options are appropriate. Correct.
Yeah. And we even, for our solo provider organizations, we even specify that we would like somebody to be peer reviewing them as well, so they can send those out to a different physician who can review those as well.
Right. And actually, that same center that I was just referring to, that's exactly the situation. The doctor worked alone, but he had a friend down the road who he was able to get to do chart audits, and it was actually working out very well. He didn't have to pay him because they had a professional relationship anyway, and the chart reviews, by the way, are very good. So it was nice to see that they were taking it seriously.
Yeah, that's great.
So what's another area of concern?
So to keep on the topic of credentialing and privileging, for our Medicare deemed status clients, what we've seen specifically rise, and again, this is the number two issue that we've seen for those clients, is privileging. So our standard there, which also corresponds with a CMS requirement, is that privileges must be granted for specified procedures for a specified period of time. The healthcare professional must be legally and professionally qualified, and those privileges must be granted based on the applicant's request for those within their scope of service. So a couple opportunities for challenge within that one standard where I see the organizations kind of miss the mark or forget to incorporate is that part where I said specified procedures. So it's not enough just to give anesthesia privileges or laser privileges. Really what we're looking for there is that they're specified that's taking place. So what laser are you giving privileges for? What level of anesthesia? A lot of times what we find with our orgs is they've forgotten to include a privilege for local or topical anesthesia. And that's such an easy fix, but it is something that we do have to cite them for in that area. The other part of that, of course, is the specified period of time. So making sure that it's clear on that privilege list that how far it extends. So are you privileging every 2 years? Are you privileging every 3 years? Our standard does require that it be no more than every 3 years. So making sure that that's identified not only in the organization's records, but also that it's identified to the applicant there.
Right. And one of the suggestions I make is that the privilege term should actually be stated right in the governing body minutes. That way there's no doubt about it. And of course, the letter that goes to the provider after they've been privileged.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Moving on. Okay, so that kind of brings us home with the credentialing and privileging. Our top issue for our non-Medicare deemed status organizations is in our clinical records chapter. So that's our standard 6H, which talks about reports, histories, and physicals, progress notes, and other patient information such as lab reports, x-ray readings, op reports, and consultations are reviewed and incorporated into the record as required by the org's policies. So that was a mouthful to say,
right.
And you can appreciate that there's a couple different data points within that of things that were not consistently incorporated into the record. So making sure that everything's getting back in that record as it should according to that organization's policy.
So one of those areas probably is also the medication reconciliation?
Yes, absolutely. So that would be something else that we're looking for in our clinical records, certainly.
Right, as well as presence and absence of allergies. I think one of the common things that we see is the failure to put the reaction in there.
Right. Yeah, and I think that it's important for an organization, especially with allergies, to just define a consistent location. When you're looking for an allergy and you have to dig through the record, that's not really a helpful activity. So you want to make sure you're highlighting those in a consistent place. And yes, to your point, not only recording the allergy, but also the reaction to that allergen.
So while we're on the topic of clinical records and histories and physicals, let's just talk a little bit about the CMS's recent guidance with regard to it's actually aimed at regulatory reduction. And we know, and yes, we talked about it in a previous episode, that one of those items mm-hmm. that they've proposed removing is the 30-day requirement of an HMP. So what is Triple HC's position on this?
So it's really important for us as an organization to make sure that we're reviewing any changes that come through and defining our own position on that. So I was happy to hear that you reaffirmed, and I've seen this consistently be done for any organizations that are announcing these changes, that everybody should make sure that they check with their accrediting body before they make any changes to their program. So currently, Triple HC is still reviewing those changes which become effective. I believe it's November 30th by CMS. Triple HC is defining our own position. This is especially with the history and physical. This is a requirement not only for our Medicare deemed status clients, but also for our non-Medicare deemed status clients. So that's something that we want to be consistent with program to program and make sure, again, that we actually believe in what we assess for. So no changes right now, but that's something that organizations will be notified of if and when they do change. There's a public comment period. Anytime we change standards, we want to hear feedback on that before we make that change official. So if and when we do decide to make any changes, that would be something that organizations would be notified about. I do want to highlight that with that regulatory change, Medicare has instituted that an organization must have a policy about when they're going to conduct histories and physicals. So I would advise organizations to take a look at that as they're reviewing the changes, keeping in mind that right now we're not changing anything. So you might want to document that you do how you do histories and physicals, what time frame you do. But we are keeping the 30-day requirement as of now.
Very good. Now, in looking at your clinical record comments, one thing kind of popped out to me, and that was there was some issues with no documentation of the ER transfer follow-up and no discharge summaries included. Now, I happen to know that we have some issues also, especially in New York City, with clients mm-hmm. that have a very difficult time getting a hold of the discharge summaries. But I was surprised that this rose to the top, especially with regard to the lack of documentation for the emergency room follow-up. That seems pretty serious.
Absolutely. I mean, you're not the only one that has had challenge getting those summaries back. So as a surveyor, I'd love to hear your tips on what's worked for you in some organizations. But yeah, we do see that organizations do struggle. I mean, we definitely want to make sure that absolutely one of the standards is that those summaries are provided with the patient who's being transferred. But getting them back can be difficult for organizations.
So one of the recommendations we make to our New York City clients is that, well, and probably everybody, is that in the consent to treatment or the consent for the procedure, they should include words to the effect that if the patient is transferred to the hospital, that you authorize the surgery center to obtain the discharge summary from the hospital. That seems to be helping mm-hmm. our New York City clients. So thanks for
bringing
that.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. Yeah.
Sure. Okay, how about another area?
For our Medicare deemed status clients, our top issue was found in our infection control chapter, and that is really talking about the overall program reduces the risk of healthcare-acquired infection as evidenced by education and active surveillance, consistent with CDC and other nationally recognized guidelines for safe injection practices. So here we're seeing kind of a multitude of issues, and I did want to highlight that one of the documents that is available to organizations is the infection control work worksheet that CMS uses on its surveys. We have our own infection control worksheet, which our surveyors use, that's modeled after that. So as we talk about an organization's readiness for survey, that's definitely a tool that they can incorporate to go through and audit their own program to know exactly what we're going to survey for there.
And I will upload a copy of the most recent, which I believe is dated 2015, the one that is applied to the surveyors. Of course, as you said, Triple HC has their own, but it's based upon the 2015 document,
yes,
if I remember right.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, and then we'll last the top three to round that out.
Sure.
Our next area for Medicare deemed status, our last one that we'll talk about today, is in our anesthesia chapter. And this is actually related to and maybe cited for some of the same reasons, but it talks about a safe environment for providing anesthesia services is ensured through the provision of adequate space, equipment, supplies, medications, and appropriately trained personnel. And written policies must be in place for safe use of injectables pills and single-use syringes and needles. So again, another mouthful of a standard, couple different data points within that one. So that may be why we see it rise for different reasons. But keeping in mind that that's kind of a catch-all standard for safety in general when talking about anesthesia.
And I think just my experience in the surveys that I've done recently and when we do mock surveys is making sure that the anesthesiologist labels any syringes that he draws up with the drug, the dose, the strength, his or her initials, and the time that it was drawn up or the expiration of that, which is within 1 hour. We actually had a situation recently where we had an anesthesiologist that argued with the surveyor that the number was 12 hours, not 1 hour. We were trying to keep him quiet during the survey, but unfortunately, he had very strong opinion about it, and we had to explain that he was wrong.
Always good to provide that on-the-spot education, to see it as an educational opportunity.
It was a little embarrassing for us, though, but as a client, you know. But HHHC was right. They got the right time there, but it was not the type of thing I want to have during a survey. I would have liked to have that conversation beforehand.
You win some, you lose some.
That's right. So I understand that you have a new subscription program coming out also.
Yes. So we'll talk about kind of some of my recommendations that I've highlighted from this report. And one of them is going to be something we're really excited about, and that's a change to the way that we're conducting benchmarking studies in 2020. New for 2020, we've got an annual benchmarking study subscription model that we think will provide a better experience and really more value to the participant. So that's something that really kind of dovetails nicely with our 1095 Strong approach. So our 1095 Strong campaign, if your listeners are not aware of it, 1095 is the number of days in a 3-year term of accreditation. And that is something that we've really been focusing on a lot here and thinking about how we can support organizations, not only when we walk through the door every 3 years, or maybe on a random survey, but all the way throughout the term. So it's another way that we also hope that organizations would, value their approach to accreditation. So you're staying accreditation ready throughout your term, not just the 2 months before your survey when you're breakneck, pace trying to prepare for that. So the benchmarking studies, we believe we'll have increased participation to increase the value of those reports and be able to provide more robust data. So basically, once an organization takes advantage of the subscription, as opposed to signing up for one study at a time or purchasing those individual study reports, they'll actually get access to all of the studies that we're doing in that year, which could potentially save thousands of dollars in those registration fees or the cost of purchasing those study reports. So we always want to provide organizations with a lot of usable data. So more information will be available on that to organizations, but we're really excited about it.
Do you have some examples of some of the benchmarking that is that you hope to do in 2020?
Yes. So we've split out our study topics into things that apply to all of our accredited organizations or that are universal. And then we have some surgical specific ones. So since this is an ASC podcast, I'll highlight some of those. We've got a study on colonoscopy, YAG laser posterior capsulotomy, and cataract extraction with lens insertion studies.
So can you also talk a little bit about the accreditation handbook and the status of the revisions to it?
Yes. So we will be publishing new standards at some point next year. So again, we'll be letting organizations know about that. We did have public comment periods on some of those new standards that are coming, but we really want to make sure that we're focusing. We haven't seen an update for our Medicare deemed status clients since our book came out in 2017. So the most current version is a 17-18 handbook. So we want to make sure that we're updating that. And again, like I talked about earlier, making sure that our accreditation standards are consistent program to program, in addition to the added benefit of those conditions for coverage being covered on a Medicare deemed status survey. So that's an exciting upcoming thing for next year. Some more information will be available about that in 2020.
And we should also point out that we are still waiting for CMS to come up with revisions to the interpretive guidelines, which are long overdue, but we haven't had any revisions. We had major revisions when it came to the emergency preparedness plans, but that didn't actually get into the interpretive guidelines themselves. A separate set of interpretive guidelines was created for emergency preparedness. So we're anxious to see how they revise the interpretive guidelines specifically for the conditions for coverage, which were last published in 2015.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're looking forward to that as well. One of the areas that had been changed in addition to emergency preparedness, of course, is the life safety code, the change from the 2000 edition to the 2012 edition. So yeah, we anxiously await that as well. And I do have a bonus on that note, a bonus top deficiency for our Medicare clients on life safety code. I know it's everyone's favorite subject, but this one, actually one of the top deficiencies, which I think is something that organizations can proactively take an approach to make sure that they're in compliance with, is the item that discusses penetrations through the firewall. Mm. So almost 50% of our Medicare deemed status clients did have some penetration that was found on the survey. And keeping in mind that that can be a very simple, easy fix that an organization can go and assess for themselves. But if it is large enough, or if there's many different penetrations, that can result in a condition level deficiency. So it's very important to pay attention to it. I always like to try, when I'm thinking about life safety code, to think about the intent behind that. And really that speaks to the integrity of the firewall. So making sure that if there's a fire going on next door, that firewall is going to be in place for an hour so that you can safely evacuate patients. So once you start punching holes through that and you turn your wall into Swiss cheese, that can kind of affect the integrity. So it's an easy way that when organizations have somebody coming in and installing or running cables or doing things above the ceiling panels, making sure that you're peeking in and knowing that those are all appropriately sealed.
It's one of the easiest things to have somebody look at, too. And it doesn't necessarily require somebody with an awful lot of expertise. They just have to seal it with the fireproofing there. So you're right. It would be so – it's one of those things that it's kind of disappointing when a center does get cited for it, because it's one of those easiest things to detect even before a survey occurs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we can't always say that the life safety code findings are able to be really reviewed by anyone. So I love that this one is an easy fix.
Sure. So tell me what's in the future for 2020? Obviously, the 1095 program is a very important part of your long range plan. But what's going on? You're doing very well right now, obviously, with the number of surveys that are going on and the number of organizations.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about the benchmarking study changes to that program, but we also have a new learning management system. Talking about that 1095 approach, it's called 1095 Learn. And that's available at learn.triplehc.org. And that's chock full of webinars and resources for organizations. And we're planning to expand and get more of those resources available to clients. Also, if organizations are interested in our Achieving Accreditation program, that is the system in which they would go to register for those programs. And just a tip on that Achieving Accreditation program, we're going in 2020 we'll be in Florida, we'll be in California. So we try to do those kind of all over the U.S. And those are not only for organizations that are new to accreditation or about to undergo initial surveys, but also for organizations to come and learn, you know, throughout their accreditation term on what's new at HHC and what our surveyors are seeing. So we have a very high satisfaction rate for anybody that attends that program. So we love to be able to put those on 3 to 4 times a year. So that's always a great way to come out and see us throughout the accreditation term.
And those accreditation programs run simultaneously with surveyor retraining. I know that because I'm going down to Las Vegas, I think, in December for retraining. And I believe that's your next Achieving Accreditation conference, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that's in December. That's always a very popular program. Everybody loves Vegas, and we love being there. So, and that is, like you said, that is one that we do double duty at. So love to get our surveyors out there, in addition to being faculty members, to have them kind of in the same venue as our clients that are eager to learn. It's great. It's a great opportunity.
I'm certainly looking forward to it, especially with the way the weather has turned south. Well, you're in Chicago, so you know what it's like up here in Rochester, too. Certainly, it's getting colder.
Absolutely.
Hopefully it'll be warmer down there.
Yeah. Well, and as I said before we started recording, for Halloween, Chicago decided to go as January. We got a bit of snow here, so nobody's really happy about some changing leaves and snow then on the branches, but we're dealing with it. We're tough cookies in Chicago.
It was funny. I was actually in Texas with one of the HHC surveyors who visited one of my centers down in Texas yesterday, and he's from Florida. And the temperature in Dallas, outside of Dallas, was 32 degrees. Actually, I hopped on the airplane at 50 degrees up in Rochester and got down there to 32 degrees. Something is seriously wrong when the temperatures are going in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. All over the place.
Thank you so much, Taryn. I really appreciate your time. I'm glad we finally were able to get together and take care of our technical problems. What our audience doesn't know is we tried recording this last week and the recording didn't even come out. So thank you for your patience with us. And I'm glad we were able to get the technical difficulties taken care of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, practice makes perfect.
That's right.
And I've loved being here. So thanks so much for having me. I'd love to come and do this again.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And again, we want to thank Taryn for that great interview and for putting up with our technical problems. And we hope to interview some people from the Joint Commission for future episodes. We have reached out to them, but they really haven't gotten back to us yet, as well as some individuals from Quad ASF. We do have an upcoming interview, Sue, with IMQ, a California-based accrediting organization that now covers most of the U.S. We just haven't been able to fit that into our schedule yet, but I hope to get that out sometime in December. So let's take a short break and come back and talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com. I also want to remind you that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. John is available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting.
So upcoming this week, the Pennsylvania ASC Association meeting will be November 4th, 2019 at the Hershey Lodge in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
The ASC Association has an upcoming webinar titled CMS Burden Reduction Rule Update, where they will examine the final rule for regulatory provisions to promote program efficiency, transparency, and burden reduction, and the impact it will have on the Medicare conditions for coverage, and that is coming Tuesday, November 5th at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. It is free for ASCA members and is $150 for non-members, and of course it will be also available after the webinar if you miss it.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference is in Tarrytown, New York on November 6th and 7th, 2019. Of course, we're going to be there, as we mentioned earlier, recording two episodes.
And the California Association's 12th Annual Seminar, Infection Prevention and Surveillance in the ASC, is November 7th and 8th in Costa Mesa, California.
Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th, 2019 at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
And the HHC Achieving Accreditation, which is an interactive, in-depth, two-day seminar designed to help organizations prepare for the HHC survey, is December 6th and 7th in Las Vegas, and the next seminar after that is March 13th and 14th in Miami.
And I actually will be attending the Achieving Accreditation. Actually, I go for a retraining in HHC for, you know, surveyor retraining, so I'll be there. So make sure if you're going to it that you say hi. The ASCA 2020 Winter Seminars is in New Orleans, Louisiana, January 16th through the 18th. You need to sign up by November 15th, lock in the early bird registration rates. The seminar features three ASC-specific tracks, finance and accounting, coding and reimbursement, and ASC management. And I'll be speaking on the finance and accounting track.
And the AORN Global Surgical Conference in Anaheim, California is March 28th to April 1st. And we're in the process of finalizing plans to be at the conference and recording a special episode there. Thank you to AORN for allowing us to attend. We're very excited about that.
I know. And, you know, thank you, Sue, for bringing it to my attention that this is, you know, this is, of course, the premier ambulatory surgery conference for, you know, for nurses and especially in the operating room.
Yep.
And that was a great idea you had. And, of course, our dear friend Ann Geyer is one of the principal speakers there. So we knew she was going to be there. But I'm very happy that they have agreed to let us come. So more news to come. The Iowa Association of ASC's 12th Annual Education Conference is April 17th and 18th, 2020 in Johnston, Iowa.
And ASCA 2020 is in Orlando, Florida, May 13th through the 16th. It is the ASC industry's most highly regarded and well-attended event. Attendees include physicians, administrators, nurses, managers, and owners of ASCs from all across the country and throughout the world. At ASCA's annual conference, you'll find more than 50 educational sessions designed for ASC professionals at every level, nationally recognized ASC management experts, networking opportunities with more than 1,000 of your colleagues, hundreds of exhibitors who can help you find the solutions your ASC is looking for, the latest regulatory and accreditation updates. Make sure you sign up to attend. We'll, of course, be there like we always are.
We always are. And again, we'll have most of our staff there. It's a big investment we make every year, but it's by far the most important conference of the year. So,
well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again, and please consider becoming a patron by going to our website at ascpodcast.com and spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.